This is Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flato. This week, doctors announced that they have grown functioning human bladders in the laboratory and have successfully transplanted them into people. The bladders were implanted in 7 children who had poorly functioning bladders as a result of birth defects. After receiving their new bladders, all the patients showed improved urinary incontinence. As you might imagine, this success, the first lab-grown organs to be implanted into humans, has been hailed as a milestone, and it has many people asking, perhaps yourself, okay, what's next? Hearts? Lungs? Livers? Will doctors someday be able to make organs to order, for example? You have a bad kidney? Let's order up a replacement kidney for your ailing body or your aging body as the baby boomers get older. And why stop at internal organs? How about new arms or legs or eyes? And what about mechanical, bionic parts like, you know, Steve Austin to replace the body parts that don't function anymore? Bionics research is a very, very hot topic. It's underway in labs across the country. And this hour, we're going to take a look at the cutting edge of all of this research and whether anyone can afford all these parts if they are produced and if they are available. Are they going to be too expensive? You know, we talked about the $6 million man. We're talking here the $6 billion man. And so if you'd like to get in on the conversation, our number is 1-800-989-8255. 1-800-989-TALK. Let me introduce my first guests. Stephen Badalak is a research professor in the Department of Surgery, University of Pittsburgh. He's also director of the Center for Preclinical Tissue Engineering at the McGowan Institute for Regenerative Medicine. He joined us by phone. Thanks for being with us today, Dr. Badalak.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Michael Lysett is a professor of medical science and engineering and the director of the Center for Biomedical Engineering at Brown University in Providence, Rhode Island. He joins us by phone. Thank you for being with us today, Dr. Lysett.
Nice to be here.
Dr. Badalak, tell us about this new bladder. Why is this a breakthrough?
Well, what Dr. Atala reported earlier this week is fundamentally a proof of principle that that one can take cells that are harvested from your body, mix them with an appropriate scaffold, do something with them outside the body, and then take them back in to the patient to fix a broken body part. A lot of that type of work has been conducted over the past decade in preclinical animal studies, but this is the first report of it being done in humans with long-term follow-up. And so I think much more than anything else, it's a proof of principle that gives hope to others in the field that this can really work. And I think it's just the beginning. There are a lot of limitations to it, which we'll probably get into during this hour, but it certainly is I would consider it a breakthrough, yes.
You talked about a scaffolding. Can you give us an idea of the technique that was actually used to create the bladder?
Sure. What Dr. Atala did was to take a biopsy of the patient's normal bladder tissue and then separate the cells out that make up that particular organ, the urinary bladder. Then in culture, place these cells on an artificial scaffold. The one that he used in some of his patients is called polylactic glycolic acid, or PLGA for short. It's the name isn't as important as the fact that it's a synthetic and degradable scaffold. And alternatively, he could use another scaffold, a biologic scaffold, which would be derived from another human, and just take the scaffolding material called the extracellular matrix. He can use either of those scaffolds, seed the cells on it, and those are very suitable substrates, and then the cells proliferate and hopefully self-assemble into a bladder-like tissue. And then that tissue, once it begins to look and enough like a bladder and have enough mass to be of use to the patient, is then surgically implanted into the patient to fix whatever the defect might be. The limitations of it are that, of course, in culture, it doesn't develop a blood supply or a nerve supply, so that particular aspect of the remodeling is counted on as happening in the patient.
So how many organs, whether, you know, you've done this in the bladder, what about other organs like the liver or the kidneys, other organs, Are they amenable to this scaffolding building process and implantation also?
Well, theoretically they are, but practically there are a lot of limitations. The bladder is, and I use this term relatively simple compared to, say, the liver or the kidney, which has more cell types and arranged in a more complex pattern. In the laboratory, scientists have been able to grow almost every cell type. We can grow nerve cells, can grow liver cells, kidney cells, heart cells. You can even see little pieces of beating heart tissue in a test tube. But taking those pieces of tissue and then taking them back to the patient is not nearly as simple. So it's sort of halfway there. We know how to grow these things outside of the body. Now how do we make them functional for the patient? And maybe more importantly, how do we integrate this sort of science into the practice of medicine today?
Right. And let me ask Dr. Lysett about that. How expensive would it be for people who are not laboratory test subjects like these people were to create something for them like this?
Well, you know, all of the organ replacement technologies that are out there today, the first generation that you spoke about in the introduction, tend to be fairly expensive. You know, to get a new pacemaker, an artificial hip, you're looking at $10,000, $20,000, $30,000 for the total cost of the device, the implantation, the rehabilitation, and so forth, and then a maintenance cost every year. So I think that the price, once these reach a large volume, will probably be in that same range. An organ transplant, for example, you know, a kidney transplant for the first year, the kidney's free, but everything that goes with it probably ends up costing $80,000 to $100,000. Liver transplant, $300,000 to $400,000. So these are all very big-ticket items. There's no question about it. But they allow people to live longer lives and higher quality lives, significantly higher quality lives, and society just has got to decide, is that how they want to spend their resources?
Could we expect to see this? I'll ask you, Dr. Badalak, also Dr. Lysett, can we expect to see the bladder treatment find its way to the mainstream public now?
Well, it's a very, very special and small subset of patients that actually are eligible for the bladder. So far, at least, in its current form, the cells have got to be harvested from children, not from adults, because child cells have a greater ability to proliferate. And the greatest need for bladder replacement is in bladder cancer, which is an adult disease, and where the use of the patient's own cells might be problematic. So I think if it becomes a therapy, it will be a niche therapy initially, 500 to 1,000 patients maybe in the United States. And then as it develops and emerges, it may become a much, much larger scale therapy.
Mm-hmm. Would it be possible to use therapeutic cloning, stem cells, here to grow the same kind of cells, bladder cells, on a matrix for adults where, as you say, they're not proliferating at that age?
If you could get them, yeah.
Yeah.
Be ideal. By the time you get to be an adult, you don't really have pluripotent stem cells left.
But I think there are several alternatives for doing exactly what you'd indicated there. And there are, of course, many different types of stem cells. And let me just give you a couple of examples. There's been talk, for example, of patients, of parents collecting the blood from the umbilical cord of their newborn babies, freezing these cells back, which are rich in stem cells, just in case someday this particular patient develops a need for such a therapy. In that case, of course, you've got a rich cell, a source of the patient's own cells that are very vigorous and vital and a potential use. Now, that sort of strategy is talked about, and there are some blood, you know, cord blood banks now being started, but of course it's going to be decades before that becomes a reality. There are stem cells being identified in every tissue, And every patient has them, but Dr. Lysot's correct in that as you get older, the numbers of them get less. But I think this is the promise of stem cell therapy, that if we can understand how to make a stem cell turn into a urinary bladder or a liver or a heart, then we certainly have an almost unlimited source of cells. The thing we need to remember is that they need, when cells are used in this type of a treatment, they really need to be the patient's own cells. Otherwise, the patient needs to be subjected to immunosuppression to suppress the immune system, like patients that get kidney transplants. And that decreases from the quality of life. So I think the goal of regenerative medicine and tissue engineering is to get around that.
Dr. Badalak, will there be a time when we're able to actually regenerate limbs, like, you know, some of the animals do?
Well, you know, that is, again, another level of complexity, but we believe that is going to be possible once we understand more about the signals that turn on and turn off normal development. Let me give you an example of a strategy that sort of tells you that it can happen. You know, in a developing fetus, you can cut off a portion of a limb, and if the fetus is young enough, it'll grow back the entire limb, just like a starfish or a salamander. And then as the course is in a newborn, up to a couple of years of age, you can cut off the end of the finger, and it will regrow to be a totally normal finger, no scars, no nothing. We turn into a teenager. We can't do that anymore. We start to get more scarring, and as we get an adult, we can barely do it at all, and we develop scars all the time. So what is it's the same patient, just healing in a different way as it goes through life, from a developing fetus all the way out. Well, so one strategy, you know, that would be either a
Dr. Battle, back, we have to go to a break, and I don't want to cut you off in the middle of your strategy. So hang on to that thought,
I will.
And we'll talk about your strategy for regenerating limbs, which is going to be quite interesting when we come back after this break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about tissue engineering and bionics with my guests, Stephen Badalak, research professor in the Department of Surgery, University of Pittsburgh. Michael Lysot is professor of medical science and engineering and director of the Center for Biomedical Engineering at Brown University in Providence. And when I rudely interrupted Dr. Badalak, he was telling us about his strategy for regeneration of limbs. Would you continue, please?
Well, it wasn't so rude, but what we were talking about was the way that a fetus heals differently than a child versus an adult. And one strategy that I think has a lot of potential is understanding how we turn on and off those signals that make us heal more like a fetus. And really, all we would need to do is turn it on temporarily. You know, say you get you amputate a finger. Well, if we understood the signals that said, how did that finger develop when we were a fetus, and we were able to turn those genes on and turn the other ones off that were keeping it from happening, just like we did when we were little, we could theoretically regrow that body part and let nature take its course. And that way we're not supplying cells necessarily. We don't need scaffolds even, maybe. We just need to understand the mechanisms for turning on and off these signals. So there are lots of approaches to regenerative medicine, and I think the value of Dr. Attell's work is to show that, you know, we're working at this. This is possible to do. You know, it's very early, and Dr. Teller would be the first to admit that and acknowledge that there's a lot of work to do, but it's, I think, extremely exciting because it offers hope to people for things that we just couldn't do before.
Are we any close? Are we able to find the genes, at least in animals, that signal the turning on and turning off? I guess I'm trying to get a sense about how close we are to discovering those mechanisms.
Well, you know, I expect we are a fairly long way away from the point that you're going to be able to regenerate entire limbs. They have identified some of the genes in animals. But even today, there are, as you mentioned earlier, very advanced electromechanical prosthetics, and it's possible to transplant hands, for example, from cadaveric donors into living recipients. So these things are evolutionary, and I think it's important to emphasize how much of the bionic vision is already in place. I mean, there are probably 40 million people in the world living with or because of artificial organs, first-generation artificial organs that have been implanted into them, people with artificial hips and knees, with drug-eluting stents, with pacemakers, people living on kidney dialysis, and so forth. And the capacity to replace a deteriorated organ with a man-made substitute is a reality for many organs today.
And well, I'm glad you made it easy for me to bring in my next guest.
Okay.
Dr. Lysett, my next guest has been working on a device to help amputees regain the function of a missing limb. He's developing a computer-controlled hand, still in the prototype stage, called Dextra. And it's amazing how much of a range of motion this hand has. He joins me now to talk about it. William Kralius is professor of biomedical engineering at Rutgers University in Piscataway, New Jersey. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira.
Tell us about this Dextra hand. Is it true that this hand can actually play the piano?
Well, when attached to an amputee, yes, it has played a slow piano piece, and it can do that, yes.
And tell us what makes your hand unique from other hands? And the hands have been around for decades.
Well, it's really nothing that special. The hand itself is really rather crude. The main breakthrough we have is the ability to extract more information from the amputee himself, and more than is currently available. So in our method basically is a non-invasive method to image the residual limb with more resolution, I think, than has been done before. People are probably familiar with the myoelectric arms that are used by many amputees and used very well. And these are used by people with transradial amputations as well as transhumeral amputations, that is above the elbow. But these, for really many decades, have been in use, have really only allowed opening and closing of a hook-like appendage, even though it looks cosmetically very much like a hand now. But they have not been able to control multiple fingers. So our breakthrough with a lot of intelligent, smart students from Rutgers and some collaborators, but with some very dedicated amputees who not only had a desire to use to play, you know, like a piano or a saxophone, but we found had the ability to express their volition with their limb, and it's probably what I call the best analogy is the phantom limb phenomenon. That is, they think about moving their various digits, and they can really visualize this. In fact, when they close their eyes, I think they imagine that they still have the hand, and that's important.
So you hook the hand up to the muscles. You have electrodes that go to the muscles in the body.
It's really not electrodes. What it really is to put a sensor sleeve on the limb that takes sort of a mechanical image of the muscles within the socket as the person is trying to make particular movements. So the individual basically trains the computer to what he wants to move, and the computer kind of learns, well, I associate these various images with these various movements, and then he simply plays it back, and the hand operates in accord with his wishes.
So he has a hand, part of an arm, attached, and the hand senses the muscle movements in his arm. That's the part that is still present, and you train it to know which of those muscle movements, what it means to do with your fingers, for example.
Yes, that's exactly it.
And how much training does it take?
Just really a few minutes. The very first time we really assembled it on our first trial amputee, it took about a few minutes, literally, and he played Mary Had a Little Lamb almost perfectly. So it to get three fingers to work coordinated fashion does not take very long at all.
Do you think that you can create or restore movement in any limb of the body this way?
Well, see, the arm, I think, is the most difficult. I think legs really are their arrhythmic activity, and the kind of technology we have now is really very, very good and doesn't require, all the kind of work that the upper limb, which the upper limb can do anything. You can do a task in an infinite number of ways, and so you really have to be well connected. The person has to be very well connected to his robotic arm, or the leg pretty much has a very set repertoire of things to do. So I think that we're really talking about the difficulty is the upper limb.
What is the main stumbling block that you are overcoming and that everybody must overcome in bionics?
Money. funding, because I would say that it's quite expensive to develop these things. And even though it's a severe problem for many people in this country and throughout the world, the funding, there's not that large of a market. It's not like selling televisions. And so that's, I would say, the number one problem. Now, if you mean technologically, really, I think everyone will recognize that the man-machine interface is the key problem to be solved, because we have the robotic technology, we have the computer technology, we have batteries, we have motors. The interface is the main issue.
You mean how much information you can get from the muscle to the arm or the other?
Yeah,
the bionic part.
That's correct. I think that there are different approaches. I mean, as you probably know, people now are looking at trying to record directly from the brain, with electrodes, and have the person do the same sort of thinking, but tap in directly there and then control the limb. And other people are trying the peripheral nerves directly within the arm with surgical techniques. Our technique, which is in use, is non-invasive, and it will have a limit. I mean, I don't think people are going to be able to, get a lot of dexterity like, playing Chopin on the piano. But I think that they'll get a lot more than they presently are given with the myoelectric.
Would they be able to walk?
To walk?
Yeah, so if someone without legs, if you put these artificial limbs on them, would they be able to walk with them?
Oh, I personally, we were not involved in making lower limb prostheses, but those are really high technology and very people. There's been a double amputee who nearly won an Olympic race.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the leg prostheses are very well designed and really can get people up and walking and running. Yeah, there's no question about that.
Somebody with an artificial leg today can run the 100-yard dash 1 second less than the Olympic record.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. I want to bring in another researcher who says they've designed a bionic eye that could cure some forms of blindness, an eye that holds the potential to give completely blind people 20/80 vision. That means to be able to read books, to use a computer, and recognize faces, the researchers say. And here, let me give you an idea how it works. There's a light-sensitive chip about half the size of a grain of rice. It's implanted behind the retina of your eye. You wear a pair of goggles that have a tiny video camera attached, and the camera sends what it sees to a pocket-sized computer processor. The computer sends the image back to the screen on the goggles. The screen projects the light onto the chip implanted in your retina. The chip stimulates neurons, cells that send signals to the brain, creating sight. And so far, the bionic eye has only been tested in rats, and it can only sense images in the infrared, sort of like black and white night vision. But it holds potential, and here to talk about it is Dr. Daniel Palanker, head of the research team creating the bionic eye. He's professor in the Department of Ophthalmology at Stanford. He joins us from Palo Alto. Welcome to Science Friday.
Good morning.
Good morning. How did I describe more or less correctly?
That's right. Yes.
How close are you to trying this out in humans? What needs to be done?
Well, at this point, we are trying bits and pieces in rats and rabbits. We are probably a couple years away from human trials of that system.
Mm-hmm. And can you give us any idea of what? I mentioned the how good the resolution was. How do you know how good the resolution is in the rat studies?
First of all, the design of the system is such that, physical limitations of the interface between the chip and the neurons and retina is such that the amount of information is limited by the size of the pixels, so pixel density, and distance between the electrodes and cells. So the maximal amount of information that we can deliver corresponds to visual acuity of 2080, as you mentioned. However, we start human trials will be started with lower resolution at about 2400, which corresponds to basically definition of legal blindness in U.S. And the second generation will be half of the size of those pixels, so it will be 2050, and then the next generation 2080. So the proximity is one of the central issues that we have to overcome. We found fascinating phenomena that basically helps us to resolve this issue. The implant having three-dimensional structure when implanted in subretinal space induces migration of the retina and integration of the neural cells with the implant. So they basically come into intimate proximity of electrodes, and that's what helps to resolve the issue of proximity to a degree of microns. We observe this phenomenon now in rats, in chronic studies, and in acute studies in rabbits. And as I said, that's what basically defines the amount of information you can deliver and ultimate resolution.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about bionics this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Dr. Palanca, are you saying that the neurons migrate to the implant and make a good tight contact with it?
That's right.
Are they trying to heal it, or are they trying to? Why do they do that?
It's probably a wound response. We don't know yet the exact mechanism that drives this. It was actually discovered only 2 years ago. We now study the driving forces behind this migration. It occurs only on subretinal side. It doesn't happen on epiretinal. That is why epiretinal approach has limited promise in terms of spatial resolution or amount of information you can deliver and visual acuity that it can achieve.
Do you think that you might have found a way to help the retina heal itself?
No, it's not the way for retina to heal itself, because in retinal degeneration, the photoreceptors die, and we are not going to restore them. Mm. We are going to interface with the surviving neurons. There are two other layers of cells in the retina, bipolar cells and ganglion cells, that process information and send it to brain. So we are interfacing with those neurons.
What would be the ultimate implant? What, you know, down the road, what would be the ultimate implant? What would it be able to do?
It will. The system, as you described already, has some hardware for image acquisition and processing outside the eye, and then information is delivered into the eye. So what it will do eventually, it will deliver information in such a way that patient will perceive images. And one of the big questions actually here is unknown so far is what kind of image processing we'll need to do in between a camera and the implant to make it perceived as an image. It took about 10 years of research for cochlear implant to come up with reasonable signal processing to make the signal understandable as sound and speech recognition. So that still is ahead of us in retinal prosthesis.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're going to go to the phones in a little bit, see if get some questions from our listeners. How far do you think until human usage of this? You said you're going to start human trials in a few years, within a couple of years?
We plan to start in 2 years. Actually, the major limiting factor for us is funding.
This is the second time I've heard on the program that funding is limiting. You would think that with all the people who could use these things, that the funding would be overflowing.
I would be happy to see it happening. It doesn't happen, however. This year, NIH reduced its budget somewhat, and it's the pay line now is about 13%. So it's very difficult to get funding, even for projects of as interesting as this one.
NIH reduced its funding.
That's right.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about that. Stay with us. We'll take a quick break and talk more with Dr. Kralius Palanker, Lysit, and Badalak, And your questions, we'll get them in there. Stay with us. We'll be right back after this short break. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about bioengineering with my guests Stephen Badalak, Michael Lyset, William Kralis, and Daniel Planker. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let's see if we can get a phone call or two in here. Chris in Napoleon, Ohio. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. This is a really great show for me because I have a 4-year-old son who's diabetic. And, you know, all the talk of being able to grow new organs, you know, would be really nice if it could happen now, but I realize that it's not yet. I was curious as to, you know, I realized they had to start with a bladder for the simplicity of the organ, but what kind of time are your guests thinking that more complicated organs, you know, may be able to be tested on humans, such as the pancreas or you know, other organ, liver, et cetera? And, you know, is there any problem with organs like that so far? Are there going to be problems with, you know, the body rejecting
right.
stuff like that? Or
each, right. each organ, this is Steve Badalak, each organ has its own challenges. And, of course, there are so many diabetics that would just do anything to have their insulin-secreting cells replaced. And it is, of course, there's a terrific amount of work being conducted in this area, has been for decades, and disappointingly, there's really been very little in terms of translation of the progress that's been made to patients yet. However, the Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation has recently, in the last couple of years, focused their efforts on treating the cause as opposed to the symptoms and signs of and outcomes of diabetes. So there's a large effort going on right now to do exactly what you want, which is to figure out how to either make your own cells turn into insulin-secreting cells that would replace those that are missing, or some of the tip of therapy similar to what Dr. Atala did with the urinary bladder. In terms of your question regarding the timeline, every organ's different. People would like to have it yesterday, of course, but it's going to be a bit at a time. There are things out there now that you may not be aware of. Cartilage cells are being taken from patients grown up and taken back to the patients now. These are being done at costs of $25,000 to $30,000. There are pieces of skin grown in a bottle that are being used to treat patients right now. You know, and Tony Talla has shown that you can take bladder. So a bit at a time. And listening to the other scientists on this show, it just, I think, gives you some idea of how complex the human body is, how in spite of all of the things that we try and do, you know, we really cannot duplicate what Mother Nature has done. And so it's, you know, we've got to come at this from all directions.
Let me focus on the pancreas for a second, because we talk about diabetes and all the time. Is this a particularly tough organ to grow on a matrix, a structure like you did for, or what was done for the bladder?
Yes, it is, because for whatever reason, these cells can be harvested from donors, but cannot be expanded to any extent in culture right now. There's an effort by the JDRF right now to see whether we can get a 100-fold expansion of these cells so that we can take one pancreas and treat multiple patients. But as of yet, that's not possible. In fact, we're not even entirely sure what the stem cell is that ends up being an islet cell, one of these insulin-secreting cells.
And this is Michael Lyset. The pancreas is particularly difficult because if you were to return an expanded line of the patient's own cells back to a diabetic individual, those cells would probably be subject to the same autoimmune attack that destroyed the original cells. So that, I mean, a pancreas is one organ that can't be transplanted between identical twins, for example, mm-hmm. because the patient's own cells have been rejected by its own body, causing the diabetes in the first place. So at least for juvenile diabetes, the challenge is perhaps, I mean, I think the bioartificial pancreas probably represents the greatest engineering challenge of the early 21st century. It's a very, very complicated organ.
I'd like to get back to the money question, because if I hear you all correctly, the stumbling blocks are not really engineering stumbling blocks here. They're funding stumbling blocks. Would that be correct?
Funding is always an issue, and unfortunately, for the first time in 35 years, the NIH has decreased its funding level. And this is not simply because people aren't interested or that they want to decrease these funds, of course. There are other priorities, that the government, has decided go before this sort of work. NIH is the most generous, massive funding institution in the world when it comes to medical research. But this sort of work is expensive, and it takes a lot of effort. And one laboratory in California or Pittsburgh or New York isn't going to do it. This is the sort of thing where you have to have many, many people working on it, all working together, and one person discovering one little thing, like what Dr. Tal has done, building on something that might be done in Dr. Lysot's lab or someone else's lab, and then eventually we get there. But money is always a limiting factor. All of us could use more money.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kralius, Dr. Palanker, what about private funding if you're creating bionic parts? Would there not be a market for them?
Well, I think the market for upper limb prostheses is generally considered to be quite low.
If you go to a VA hospital these days, you'll see plenty of them.
Right. And you can get people walking quite cheaply with century-old technology, and you can get people at least having a hook with century-old technology. And so the incentive to improve that is simply not there.
For vision, for retinal prosthesis, the market is considered to be quite large, and there is some indeed interest in private sector. There are actually two companies in the U.S. In this market, and two in Germany, and I think there is one in Japan at least. However, there is a lot of basic research still remaining to be done in university environment, and the funding from private institution into university, this link is quite problematic. So a lot of conflict of interest issues, and it's not easy to implement. However, we are looking into that right now because NIH's funding is so tight.
Ira, you may or may not know, too, that a significant amount of funding for this type of work, particularly the prostheses, comes from the Defense Department, not the NIH. And they have parallel efforts in both better prostheses that need to be developed as well as limb and digit regeneration. We have a human clinical trial beginning later this year on digit reconstruction down at Fort Sam Houston that is funded entirely by the Defense Department. This is people don't think of the Defense Department as a funding source, but in fact a lot of monies actually do come out of there, and it's recognized as a priority.
And the Veterans Administration has a very large program directed specifically at improved prosthetic limbs for traumatic limb loss.
If you can get tissue cells to grow on a structure, why can't you lay down a path, for example, for nerve cells in a spinal cord and have nerve cells regenerate and grow along that kind of pathway?
Well, this is being exactly that. Pathways laid out, and nerve cells can be stimulated to grow along those pathways, and they can be done in culture. The problem is the same as was identified earlier on the artificial hand. It's the interface between what you make outside of the body and then when you try to take it to the body. I think that this is an important question that needs to be addressed, whether or not the ideal path is to try to figure out how to do it outside the body and translate it in, or whether how to use the body as a bioreactor and stimulate the signals that let the body build these things so that it integrates it in while it's being made, so to speak.
1-800-989-8255. Rick in Lebanon, Oregon. Hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you, Ira. I appreciate you taking my call. I'm a family physician. I practice here for 25 years. The last 20 years of my life, I've been trying to figure out how to get basic health care for all, like immunizations and prenatal care. And this discussion is wonderful. It's really about hope. But when I come to it, I feel like a curmudgeon because I come saying, how are we going to pay for it? 50 million people in this country without access to basic health care, industry feeling that they're non-competitive worldwide because of their health care costs, yet we continue to develop technologies, which we should, that cost more and more for a smaller number of people. And who decides who's going to pay for it? The VA is paying with tax dollars. We have all sorts of competing needs around health care, so we haven't really decided who should pay, who should decide, who should get. Mm-hmm. And we also sort of have a everyone should live forever and not have health problems. So I'm really concerned about how we balance the expanding technology with the costs and the fact that we currently don't provide basic health care to 15 to 20% of our population.
Dr. Lysa, do you have any comments on that?
Well, I think it's a very good question. How a society chooses to allocate its resources is really what it comes down to. I don't see a direct link between developing technologies that will let people live longer or live better lives and a higher quality life on one hand, and dealing with the problem of the uninsured on the other hand. That's more of a problem of distribution of resources rather than availability. I mean, I just think that we should spend and be willing to spend money on providing better lives for our citizenry rather than on, say, faster digital pornography or bigger gas-guzzling cars. It's a higher and better use of those resources, and it's just a matter of policy and politics until the money is channeled in those directions.
We're talking about bionics this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News, 1-800-989-8255. Gentlemen, in the few minutes we have left, if you could make a breakthrough on some area of your own, and what area would you like that breakthrough to come from? And let me begin with Dr. Badalak first.
Well, I think we're very close in the area of stem cell research, and I think there's always this concern that when the word stem cells used, people think of human embryonic stem cells and the ethical issues there. I think we need to do a much better job of educating the public in terms of the many, many different types of stem cells that are there and the importance of understanding how to get these cells to do what we want them to do and then translating that into clinical practice. We cannot afford to be out of this game. It is the area that has absolutely the most potential to change the practice of medicine and the quality of life within our lifetime. I'm not talking about something 10, 20 years from. I'm talking within the next 5 to 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Kralius?
Well, my immediate aim, I think, is, I'd like it within my lifetime, and that would be to basically take and be able to give people who need it today a lot more functionality in their hand. People who are transradial amputees, even transhumeral amputees, to be able to take the signals that they're giving right in their arm and translate it into movements that they can enjoy and use.
Mm-hmm. And what would you need? What kind of breakthrough would you need there?
It's really, I guess it's not so much a breakthrough as a follow-through, the way I look at it, is because right now in my laboratory with many students, we have a lot of different techniques that can be implemented out in the market, out in the commercial usage market, to give people more functionality. I think coupling the various technologies, for instance, there's hands that are available, developed in England, developed in Germany, that could be coupled with our new interface technology that would get people today who only have a hook out there and be able to do things like play the saxophone a little bit with their residual limb, as well as type, and be able to do a lot more versatility than they can presently do.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Palanker?
I think we'll see in a few years a very significant progress in restoring sight of the blind, people having retinal degeneration, and one of the most important unknowns here that we'll be able to address as soon as we have high-resolution implants in the human eyes is the question of image processing that we'll be able to address, and this, I think, is one of the biggest questions remaining, what image processing we will have to perform outside the eye so patients will be able to perceive this information as coherent images.
Dr. Lysette, last word.
Well, thank you. I think that it's really, there are three levels that these activities are going on. The first is to continue to evolve the first generation of artificial organs, the hips, the knees, the pacemakers. And a good example of that is stents, where stents that are available today function awful lot better than those that were available 10 years ago. The second area is to add a little biologic functionality to man-made organs, and that's what tissue engineering is going to do, to allow organs to grow and remodel and be accepted into the body, and that's where Dr. Atallah's great contribution, which the bladder is really valuable.
Quickly, I've got just a few seconds left.
And then finally, as Steve said, is stem cells. That really is the ultimate achievement that I think we're looking for.
I'd like to thank all of you for taking time to be with us, Dr. Stephen Badalak, Dr. Michael Lysette, Dr. William Kralius, and Dr. Daniel Palanker. Thank you for taking time to be with us today. And good luck to all of you.
Thank you.
We'll be
thank
checking
much.
In. This program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Our directors are Sarah Handel in Washington, Charles Berquist in New York. Our interns are Flora Lichtman and Andrea Thompson. Becky Vlamis and Susan Lund work the phones for us today. Please surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com if you missed any of the links. We have them up there today. Also, we're podcasting and blogging on Science Friday. We invite you to join in. And also, Science Friday's Kids Connection is there. Free teaching materials, including what we talked about today, available for you to just take with you, download, and help teach science in your class, including Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.